I'm going to be talking today a little bit about some work that I do on children's word learning. And I thought it might be useful before we even begin to just try to situate this broadly, because there's a lot of different people who study language acquisition, and they study it for a lot of different reasons. So my training is primarily as a cognitive psychologist and to a minor degree also as a linguist. My interest in language acquisition is mostly a theoretical interest. I'm interested in what are the basic processes involved in a child learning a language. I'm interested in understanding how those processes come together in real time and over developmental time. Now, there's a lot of other reasons for being interested in language, too. People can be interested in individual variation among children. They can be interested in language acquisition and how that relates to education. So I'm just here representing a very, very, very small part of that field. So I'm actually going to be talking about two different lines of work today. One of these is a line of work that I started in graduate school, and that's what the 20 refers to, where I attempted to try to simulate early word learning in adults. And then I'm going to tell you about another line of work that has been going on in my lab for the last couple of years, where we're looking at children who are acquiring English as a second language because they've been adopted internationally. And that's where the early word learning at 4 comes in, where we're looking at preschool children. And in all of this work, I've had numerous wonderful collaborators. There'll be a slide at the end which thanks them all. But I should mention that the international adoption work is with Joy Guerin, a graduate student in the psychology department right now. Laura Axe in your class is also working on that work, along with several undergraduate research assistants who have been involved. The basic question that I've been interested in is, how is it that children begin to learn words? What kind of processes are involved? And how do those change as we become sophisticated adults who can pick up words quickly from sentences and the books that we read? Well, anyone who's ever thought about very early word learning has come up with essentially the same story, and that's Augustine's story, it's Locke's story. Understanding is that children learn words, they learn names for things, because at the time they hear a word like watch, right, they see a word, they see something out there in the world. The other person is looking at it, they're pointing at it, and bingo, the connection is made between the word and the object. This is Locke's version of the same story. You notice he sort of takes the person out of it a little bit more, but he says that people ordinarily will show you the thing and say the name for that thing. And more or less, this has got to be right. Why? Well, kids can't come into the world knowing words, right? They've got to pair the sounds with the concepts that they represent, so they have to learn them. And there's really no other information they could use. An adult can go look up a word in a dictionary, or they can use the sentence that a word occurs in to try to make a guess as to its meaning. These sorts of information are going to be useless to a child, because the child doesn't know the meanings of the other words in the sentence, and because the child doesn't yet know the structure of the language they're speaking. So I'm not going to say that Augustine or Locke got it wrong. They got it right. Right, to start to break into word learning, you have to look at situations and notice the words that occur in those situations. But a wide open question is just how much you could learn from this word-to-world mapping procedure, attempting to map words to things out there in the world. So what could you learn from this? Is it possible to learn all sorts of words, nouns, verbs, adjectives, abstract words? Or do children only learn particular types of words from the situations in which they occur? That's where there's a lot of room for disagreement. Now, one way we might want to start thinking about early word learning is looking at how it changes over time. So we're going to step back a little bit from the question of how children learn words and just look at some basic descriptive data. What I've plotted here is the number of words that children produce starting at about 8 months of age to 16 months of age. This is from a large-scale study using parental reports where parents check off the words their children use. And what we plotted here is the 90th percentile, the median, and the 10th percentile. And this is from work by Liz Bates and her colleagues. The point that I want to make with this is that for all of these groups, word learning is starting relatively slowly. Children are learning a few words at a time. It's taking them many months to work up a vocabulary of about 50 words. And then, boom, it starts picking up. So whatever our theory of word learning is, we want to be able to account for this fact, that word learning accelerates over time and gets faster. And here we have word learning lexical production between about 16 and 30 months, and you can watch that acceleration continuing. You'll notice that it seems to slow down at the top of the graph. That's just because we're hitting the limits of this instrument, right? This checklist has about 670 words on it, and the kids are slowing down here because they know all the words on the checklist. But other studies suggest that their word learning itself is still accelerating, getting faster and faster. In fact, word learning doesn't even slow down throughout childhood and adulthood. We only have a little bit of information on how lexical growth happens during those years, but it looks like it keeps on at the same pace till at least 18 years, with a lot of variability there afterwards. So what's happening here? Why is it so hard for an 8-month-old to learn their first few words, and why does word learning accelerate over time? Another thing, phenomenon we want to explain is why the types of words that children know change over time. Here I've just given you some examples of words that roughly 50% of children are using at around these age marks. And once again, this is coming from the parental report instruments. At 12 months, the kinds of words that are hitting the 50th percentile are things like mommy, bottle, telephone, I think was at 15 months or so during the same period of time, cup and high. This is a stage where most children are speaking just a single word at a time, and they have relatively small vocabularies, 10, 15 words or so. By around 20 months, a lot of children begin to combine words, using two words at a time. At this age, you also start to see words like go and sit, so some verbs, right? You start to see nouns that pick out parts of objects rather than whole objects, words like hand. Some really concrete adjectives like big start to come in, and spatial prepositions. Two and a half and later, word learning gets even more abstract. At this point, children are going through a syntactic explosion. Their utterances are growing in length. They're beginning to use tense markers. They're beginning to use things like articles like the and a, right? And the types of words that they produce are considerably more abstract. We get these very abstract prepositions like by, which confer to the role of someone in a sentence, right? It was hit by John. We get words like listen or think, verbs that refer to unobservable events. Right? More abstract words at this age. A lot more words as well. So the question we're trying to answer here is, why do children learn the words they learn, right? And why does lexical acquisition take the pace that it does, accelerating over time? A lot of research in this area has centered around a very narrow topic of noun learning, okay? And this goes back to an observation of Dedry Gentner's in the 1970s that children seem to be biased to learn nouns. Specifically nouns that pick out categories of objects out there in the world. And this is somewhat surprising. If you believe that children simply learned those words which were most frequent in their language, you'd expect vocabulary acquisition to look quite different. In fact, if you take this position to the extreme, you'd expect that every child would begin speaking by saying the, right? One of the most frequent words. But even if you just limit your area to nouns and verbs, if children are simply producing what they hear most frequently, we would expect them to produce verbs first. Why is that? Well, many of the verbs that we use often are very general verbs, which can be applied to a wide variety of situations, verbs like do and make. We actually have a small stock of about 15 verbs that we use extremely frequently. So if the number of learning opportunities was the major determinant of what words a child knew, they should begin by speaking these very general verbs, and nouns should only come in later. But across a wide variety of languages, English, Italian, Mandarin Chinese, Korean, you see that children's early vocabularies are dominated by nouns. Verbs seem to be underrepresented relative to their proportions in the speech that children are hearing. There's been two kinds of stories. Oh, this is just a graph that illustrates that. Again, looking at parental reports. And what you see is that at the point where children have vocabularies of about 25 to 50 words, most of those words, about half of those words are nouns, only a few are verbs, and that's true in English and Italian. You may be asking, what are all the other words, right? Because we're missing about 50% there. A lot of the words that kids know at this stage are kind of social routines, words like hi and thank you, some animal sounds, choo-choo, that kind of thing. So why is it that nouns are represented? Well, there's two broad classes of explanation that we could give. One explanation relies on children being conceptually different from adults. And the story goes something like this. Maybe children are only able to grasp the most concrete object concepts, concepts for categories of things like chair and cup and ball. If that were the case, if they can't think about relations or think about actions, then it should be impossible for them to learn the words that encode those actions and relations. Things like go or come, spatial prepositions like in or on, for example. Under this story, vocabulary development is driven primarily by conceptual change. As the child's conceptual repertoire becomes richer, the words that they're able to identify the meanings of are going to become richer as well. Possibility, and this is by no means mutually exclusive, is that the shape of children's vocabularies is largely determined by the limitations of their learning procedure. Remember, we talked a little bit earlier about the notion of a word-to-world mapping procedure, where the child just notices individual words and tries to map them on things happening in the world or objects out there in the world. Now, obviously, we're not stuck with this learning procedure forever. We begin to be able to use sentence context and richer representations to guide our word learning. But the very young child is stuck with this. And maybe the fact that they can only simply observe scenes and try to attach words to them limits the kinds of words that they can learn. They can only learn that cup means cup because cups are out there and can be pointed at, but they can't learn that go means go because going isn't tangible and easy to tie the word into the scene. Okay? Under this story, we might expect that children's vocabulary development would be largely fueled by their changing representation of language, what I'm calling here the input. As the child begins to represent the other words in the sentence, right, so they're no longer just hearing dog and go, instead they're noticing that dog is occurring with chase the cat, that go is occurring with mom to the store, they might be able to use these words surrounding the word that they're learning to try to close in on the meaning of more abstract words. So the distinction here is between conceptual change and changing representation of language. These two explanations are going to be impossible to disentangle in typically developing kids. Typically developing kids are arguably conceptually immature, right? If there is cognitive development to happen, then they still have to go through it. And they represent the input, the language, in a very simple way. So we have a confound here in typically developing kids. The paradigm that we've developed, the human simulation paradigm, attempts to break this confound, right? So one common misunderstanding is that we're not actually interested in studying adult word learning. We're interested in studying children's word learning. But we're trying to break apart two different aspects of being a child. Being a child involves being conceptually immature, and it involves having a lack of knowledge about your language. Here what we're going to try to do is take conceptually mature adults, strip away their access to linguistic information, and see whether they go through the same pattern of vocabulary acquisition that we see in typically developing children. We think of this as a simulation the same way that computer simulations are simulations. No one who does computer simulations of early word learning is interested in understanding how computers learn words. They're using the computer to actually try to get at a learning procedure and model that learning procedure. The input that we're going to use here is going to be taken from infant-directed speech, videotapes of moms and kids playing together. The learning device that we'll be using is the adult human, who's cognitively mature, but can have their access to linguistic information removed. And I'll explain just how we do that in a second. So this introduces the first topic that I've been looking at, which is starting your first words at 20. All right. Let me tell you a little bit more about the input that we use in this study. We want to look at natural interactions between mothers and their children. So what we do is we go and videotape mothers and kids playing, typically with a set of toys. Right? The children in the study I'll be telling about today are 18 to 24 month olds. We've also done this with some younger kids as well. We then take these videotapes and we transcribe all of the speech and identify the most common nouns and verbs in the videotape. Those common words are going to be our target words that the adults attempt to learn. Then we randomly select 6 instances of each target word. So if one of the most common words is cat, we'll find 6 different times when different mothers said the word cat. And those are going to serve as the input to the learning device, which is the adult human being. For each of these instances, we make a video clip, right? The video clip begins about 30 seconds before the mother says the word and ends about 10 seconds afterwards. It's these actual video clips that the adults will be watching. Now, we've got to somehow limit the adult's access to linguistic representations. So we did the simplest possible thing. We removed the audio, and then we simply put a beep where each word occurred. The adult's job is to try to figure out what word the mother said when she heard this beep. So, from the adult's perspective, the task goes something like this. You watch one video clip, you hear a beep, you write down your response of what you think the word is, you see another video clip, make another response, until you've gone through all 6 video clips, at which point you sit back and you look over your answer sheet and you try to decide what you think is the best possible meaning for this word. So you use cross-situational observation to close in on a likely meaning for this word. And I'm sure that all of you can make a pretty good guess at what that is.
Airplane?
Airplane, yes, thank you. I guess that was like kind of too much of a setup for anybody there. And that was very typical of a lot of our object scenes, right? There'd be video clip after video clip of something holding up an object, pointing at an object, right? Passing an object to someone else. So abundant social cues to the meaning of the word in this situation. Now, the results of a number of different studies using this paradigm have been very consistent. What we've found is that across a variety of stimulus manipulations, nouns are always identified more often than verbs. Our subjects don't have a lot of difficulty figuring out the meaning of nouns, in particularly concrete object terms. This is true when subjects know that they're trying to get a noun or trying to get a verb, so when we tell them the syntactic category of the word. This is also true, though, even when we give them no information about the syntactic category of the word and just tell them that it's a word, right? And that's the data that I've graphed over there on the left. We've also done this with Mandarin speakers. So one concern you might have about these studies is that we're taking adults who know the language and asking them to guess the words in their language. Would this be any different if we actually attempted to do the studies cross-culturally? So Peggy Lee and I have actually made videotapes of Mandarin-speaking parents and English-speaking parents and then crossed it so that the English-speaking adults get the Mandarin tapes and the Mandarin-speaking adults get the English tapes. And the results are broadly similar. Nouns are easier to learn than verbs. Now I've told you that nouns are easier to learn from situational observation, and that may help us to understand why it is that kids begin with so many nouns in their vocabulary. But that early noun dominance doesn't last very long. Right? By the time children are about 18 to 20 months, you start to see a lot of concrete verbs popping in. By the time they're about 30 months to 3 years, verbs don't really seem to be underrepresented at all. So I've really only told you half the story here. Now I need to explain to you how children manage to learn verbs. They can't learn them from just watching the scene. How do they do it? Well, the argument that we've been making is that this is because their representation of language changes. It's representational change that allows them to begin learning more abstract words. The argument is that children learn their first words by this word-to-world mapping procedure, right? They don't use the utterances in which the words occur at all, and the result is a bunch of nouns. However, this child who's managed to acquire a bunch of nouns is now a very different child than our linguistic novice. They can go in and represent new utterances in a very different way. They can take this initial stock of nouns and start to notice the other words that they occur with, right? So now a sentence with something like throw is no longer a bunch of unknown words. Instead, it might be something like mommy, then the word throw, right? The ball to me. Well, knowing that the sentence is about mommy, me, and the ball is going to make it much easier to focus in on what that verb might mean. So nouns are going to be helpful, the set of nouns that are in the sentence. The other representation that's going to be very valuable to the child is a representation of the grammatical structure of the sentence. And this point's a little bit harder to grasp onto. Lila Gleitman and her colleagues have argued for decades that the syntactic context in which a verb occurs can tell you a lot about the meaning of that verb. Once the child understands the grammar of her language and is able to recognize what the syntactic context is, this can also be a potential source of information for verb learning. And what I'll be telling you is it's a particularly important source for learning mental state and perception verbs. But let's step into this point a little bit deeper. So if you are a world-to-world mapper, right, you only have the situation, and you see this man there with the apple, there's a large number of hypotheses you might have about what a novel word could mean. This is a situation that we've been exploring, right? Glippet here could mean apple, eat, think, man, or give. But if you begin to represent the sentence that the word is in, gorp in this case, right, that sentence can help you close in on the right meaning. So knowing that the relationship between the man, the apple, and you might lead you to think give. Knowing the relationship just between the man and the apple might lead you to think of eat or like. Why is that? Well, some relations involve three different participants, like give, right? Some relationships, like eating or liking, necessarily involve two participants. So the number of nouns in the sentence might be a soft cue to the number of participants in the event. It might help you focus in on the relevant events in your situation. This is because there's a very close relationship in language between semantics, meaning, and structure or grammar, syntax. Intransitive verbs typically pick out things that are the agent's self-caused act, like John walks or John sleeps, things that John does himself. In contrast, transitive sentences, one of the things that they pick out, are cases where agents are acting on something which is then affected. Here, John is the agent, and ball is the entity that's affected. So these are systematic relationships between meaning, semantics, and grammar or syntax. Likewise, events that have three participants, right, typically involve transfer. So John puts the ball on the table. Mary gives the box to Jane, right? There's someone who gets something. There's someone who does the giving, and there's a thing that's transferred. These are very sensible relationships, right? You have to encode each of the entities in the sentence that is involved in the event. Another way in which syntax can provide a cue to meaning is by telling you whether there's another sentence buried inside the sentence that you're looking at. And this is in the form of a sentence complement. So when we get a sentence like John knows that the ball rolled away, this sentence inside the sentence is a proposition. And that kind of verb has to express a relationship between the actor John and an event or a proposition. So that's going to typically be a verb with mental state content or a verb with perceptual content. The child who can recognize sentence complements is going to be able to focus on these very abstract hypotheses for the meaning of a new word. So the next question I asked, and this was the chapter that I sent to you, was which verbs do novices learn, and could the input and their changing representation of the input account for the composition of their verb lexicon? And the main point I want you to get out of this slide is that children mostly have very concrete verbs in their early lexicon, right? Even though many of the verbs that they're hearing from English-speaking parents are mental state verbs. So children are hearing about 50% of the verbs that are talking about communication and mental states of the most common, but they're mostly learning concrete action verbs, and mental state verbs are not coming in until about 2.5 on some people's account, 3, 4, 5 on other people's account, right? So there's, again, an input-output disparity here. Kids hear abstract verbs. They produce most of the concrete subset. All right. And again, we can tell the same two stories about why their verb lexicons look the way they do. One story could be that very young children cannot represent mental states, perception, desires. They can only represent concrete actions, and conceptual development allows them to learn these new words. The other story could be that the way in which they learn by relying on situations doesn't help them, doesn't allow them to learn abstract mental state verbs, and they have to wait until they can represent entire sentences. After all, when I say I'm thinking, what is there in the situation, right, that allows you to know that thinking is what's being referred to? Thinking is invisible. It's inside heads. So, the motivation for the second experiment is to find out how informative linguistic context might be for verb learning, to look at whether some forms of context are more informative for action verbs, while others might be more informative for mental state verbs, and ultimately, to see if we might be able to explain children's order of acquisition of different types of verbs by looking at how their representations of the input change. So in this study, what we basically did is take our same sets of scenes, right, the 6 instances of each verb, and we manipulated them in different ways. Condition was just the video clips that I told you about earlier. So this is simply a replication of the verb portion of the previous experiment. In the next condition, what we did is we just took out the nouns that occurred in the sentence, and we gave our subjects that list of nouns, no videotape at all, and asked them to try to figure out the verb that the mother was saying. In another condition, we just gave them syntactic information, and I'll show you how we did that in just a minute. We just gave them the structure in which these words appeared and asked them to identify the verb. And then we manipulated these in all sorts of combinations and permutations. I think you end up with 8 of them, maybe, and saw which of these combinations and permutations were most informative. Different groups of subjects in each of the conditions. So we already talked about the scene sets. Here you'd see a scene, you'd hear a beep. Then you'd see another scene and hear another beep, right? Each beep is a case of the word. In the noun condition, you would be shown the nouns that occurred with the verb one at a time and asked to respond on that basis. So here the first set might be elephant and piano, the next one mommy, I, it, you, right? Drums, music, you. Another group of subjects was given essentially Jabberwocky, right? Like Lewis Carroll, what we did is we kept all of the function words of English, we turned all the other words into nonsense words so that the subjects could get a structural representation, more or less, of the sentences, but know nothing about the lexical context. And they got some familiarization to this before the study began. They understood what the different words were. So in this case, the mother said, can cax cern the busit, where cax and busit were nouns, and cern is the critical verb that they're trying to learn. Noggle cern, can po cern while lo nip new. Do we have any guesses? Lo are gonna cern new, cern the naps, cern tuggy wilm. Okay. here is play in all cases. All right, so what are the predictions? Well, if representational change can help us understand children's changing vocabulary at all, then what we should find is that the early representations, the representations we believe children have initially, essentially the visual context in which they hear the words, should provide less potent information about verb meaning than other representations that they might have. Critically, right, there's three conditions in the study that we're particularly interested in. One is the scenes condition, just the video information. The other is the scenes and the nouns together, right? Because at some point children are able to learn nouns and maybe they can combine that with the scene information and that might describe what their system is like in the next stage. Then finally we're interested in the situation where the child gets the frames and the scenes and the nouns all together and we look at whether they can learn the verbs. Because that represents the situation that a child is in who has learned many of the words in their language and understands what the cues are to structure in their language, can identify a sentence complement. Again, if we're trying to account for the composition of children's verbs, we should also expect that early representations might favor concrete action verbs, and that later representations would provide enough information about the meanings of abstract mental state verbs. Okay. So the result of all those simulations is this absolutely horrible graph here, where every color represents a condition, and every set of stripes represents a combination of conditions. And the only thing I expect you to get out of this is, gosh, if you have more information, you'll learn more. But let's break that down a little bit, because there's two contrasts that we're really interested in. One contrast is just how informative individual cues are, right? If you had to learn a verb from just a frame alone, from Jabberwocky, or you had to learn it from watching the scene, which would be more valuable? And what we can see here is that frames are actually twice as helpful as actually watching the interaction where the mother is, those Jabberwocky frames. But of course, this isn't the situation that a real child's in, right? No real child has to learn their verbs through Lewis Carroll. Maybe a little bit through Dr. Seuss, but not through Lewis Carroll. So, here are the three conditions that we think roughly represent stages in acquisition, right? Here's the child who does not yet know any of the other words and has to try to figure out the meanings of each word from the situation. Here's the child who's learned some verbs and can group together the verbs that occur in one utterance and use the situation as well to try to close in on the meaning. And you notice there's a big jump there, right? They're learning about almost, 75% more verbs once they have the nouns available to them. But look what happens when you get structure, right? Suddenly, this task becomes trivially easy. They're up at around, 90% here on a lot of very abstract verbs, things like and go, right? Come and do, think and want. These aren't impossible to learn. You just have to have structural information, right? And that's where they're doing really well. Okay. So the next question we wanted to ask is, do different types of verbs require different information sources? To look at this, I divided my set of 24 verbs, a pretty small set to begin with, into three classes. Mental state verbs like know, like, see, look. Light verbs. These are verbs that get a lot of their meaning from the nouns that they're combined with. So like do a dance, right? Take a bath. The verbs that we chose from this were do, make, come, go, and put. We borrowed them from some other commenters who had talked a bit about how light verbs might pave the way to verb acquisition in general. We figured that if this was true, then maybe you could learn light verbs simply from the scenes alone. Then finally we had a sort of junk category, which we'll call action verbs. That was basically everything else in the transcripts, all the other verbs. Some of these were very actional, like throw and push, others and hammer. Others of them simply really didn't fit into any category, like wait, but mostly action verbs there. So here we're looking at the percentage correct on the final trial for our action verbs in red, our light verbs in green, and our mental state verbs in blue, right? And we're looking at it in the scenes, nouns, and frames condition. The critical thing to notice here, there's an interaction, right? It's really hard to learn a mental state verb from looking at the situation. It's pretty easy to do it from just looking at the frame alone. In fact, context, structural context, is more informative for the action verbs, for the mental verbs rather than it is for the action verbs. In part because structural context is more complex for those verbs. They have things like that, right, which is a big indicator that it is a mental state verb. But of course, again, we're not just interested in each pure condition. We want to see what the different stages of acquisition might look like. And there's two things that should really pop out of this graph. One is that, like the last graph, it gets much easier to learn when you have more information, right? It becomes easy to learn verbs once you have structural context. But secondly, that the verbs that were once most difficult, the mental state verbs, basically impossible. I mean, if you do some analyses where you try to look at that compared to a reasonable estimate of chance, it's not above chance. To a point where they're actually the simplest verbs to learn because the structure and the situation constrain them so tightly. Okay, so that basically brings us to the end of our discussion of the human simulations. Yeah?
Simple question. Is play considered everything else, or is that a light verb?
Was play a light verb in this? No, play was actually with the action verbs. I'm not sure there's a principled basis on which to make the distinction I'm making, but it didn't appear in the list of path-breaking verbs. Those were verbs that were chosen because people have argued you could learn argument structures. You could learn syntax from learning those verbs, right? And play was not one of the ones that had been proposed to be critical to learning syntax because it doesn't really go with a canonical frame. But you're right. I mean, like a lot of verbs, play seems to have multiple meanings. And that's a key feature of the light verbs, but it doesn't end there, right? No one would say the verb turn is a light verb. And yet there's a couple of very different salient meanings of turn. There's turn around, there's turn on lights, there's turn off things, right? So that's another way in which verbs are pretty difficult. They seem to almost have families or clusters of meanings. And no one's ever been able to do a very good job of chopping these clusters into individual meanings and saying there's, like, you know, there are five turns. People disagree. Someone said there are three turns or there are only one turn. So that may explain part of the difficulty in trying to figure out verbs. Our basic argument here is this final point, right? A shift in how children represent the information might be able to account for the pattern of early verb learning. We don't need to invoke conceptual change to explain the pattern of vocabulary acquisition, because even adults who have the relevant concepts have problems learning the more abstract verbs unless they have structural information about those verbs. So usually at this point, there's some people who are sort of twisting in their chairs going, that's not being a kid, that's not being a kid, that's being an adult. And they're absolutely right, right? I put adults in a room with a TV in front of them. I've given them 2 hours, and I've looked at the kinds of words that they can learn on the basis of very limited information. And in doing so, I've simplified the problem in numerous ways, right? Now, I would argue I've at least shown that adults would have problems learning verbs despite their conceptual sophistication. But you might wonder about how these different stimulus variables interact with the questions of interest, right? Maybe what I've seen is mostly the effects of mass presentation or the limited duration of the study. As you argued, these have no communicative function for the adults, right? Maybe children mostly learn the words they learn because they want to communicate, and therefore they have very different ways of learning those words. So this has led me to study language acquisition in internationally adopted preschoolers. Okay? The kids in these studies are typically between, I guess we're at 2.5 to 6 right now. So like our adults, right, they're more cognitively sophisticated than your average 12-month-old who's just breaking into language. So we're going to step back a little bit and talk just a bit about the situation with international adoption. Okay? International adoption in the last 30 years or so has really taken off in terms of sheer numbers. And what you can see is that the vast majority of those kids have been coming from Asia, with a smaller proportion of the kids coming from Europe. But in the last 30 years, there's been about, 250,000 children who have been adopted internationally and come into the United States. And there's been a slow and steady rise in that in the last 10 years or so. This blip here in 1991 has to do with the Romanian orphanage crisis. But we're at the point where about 20,000 children a year are being adopted internationally. The two largest groups are children coming from China and children coming from the Soviet Union. Okay, so about 25% come from each of these two countries, with smaller numbers coming from South Korea, Guatemala, Ukraine, and a variety of other countries as well. Most people who study international adoption focus on the infants because most of the kids who come in are either in the first year of life or typically between 1 and 2. So they're very young at the time they enter the United States. And there's actually a lot of work going on language acquisition in these populations, in infants who come to the United States. But there's no work really going on with the preschoolers, and that's in part because they're a much smaller group. We know a little bit about early language acquisition in this population. We know that these children typically rapidly lose their first language, so they report having no knowledge of it in adulthood. They typically refuse to speak it starting sometime during early childhood. And to the naked eye, they appear to be native speakers of their second language. I think the most convincing study that looked at this was one that the group in Paris did, Pallier and others, where they looked at adults who had been adopted from Korea into France, right, and were now in their 20s. They had come to the United States between ages 3 and 8, and they reported absolutely no knowledge of Korean. So what they did is they took these folks into the scanner. They gave them some tests where they were simply listening to Korean, Japanese, Finnish, I think, and French sentences, and they were asked to try to pick out the ones that were Korean. And the behavioral data indicated that, in fact, they could not tell the Korean sentences from a hole in the ground, except, of course, to tell them from the French sentences. They had no problem with that. They couldn't distinguish from the Japanese sentences. Critically, the data from the scanner also suggested that there was absolutely no activation that was specific to Korean in that group and was any different than what you saw in native French speakers who had never heard Korean. So to the best of our knowledge, there's no neurological trace left of the language. Some of these kids came in at 8, right? They had a long exposure to that language. Many would argue that, especially in terms of their phonological systems, right, you might expect to see a decrease in plasticity after that point, but no sign that they had any access left to their first language. The scanner also obviously looked at the scanner for when they were doing the French sentences. There they saw a small difference. It seemed like the area that was activated when processing French was slightly smaller in the Korean adoptees, but no behavioral differences there as well. Okay, so it looks like in this situation of international adoption, what you basically end up with is a native speaker of their second language, a very unusual situation. We know a little bit about what happens during the process. Right? Glennon and some others have looked at toddlers, so children between about 18 months of age and 30 months of age, and they've tracked their vocabulary acquisition in the first 12 months or so. And what they find is that they're obviously initially delayed relative to their age mates because they haven't been acquiring words for a year, right? They haven't been acquiring any words in English, but they seem to rapidly catch up. So they actually seem to have vocabularies that grow faster than typically developing children's. Yeah.
In the language education literature, there's a claim that in the situation you would expect the kids to be able to learn Korean faster, at least, or have better control of Korean speech sounds.
Mm-hmm.
And if that's, I don't know what data there is on it. I know it's a claim in the world. That would, of course, suggest that there is some neurological trace. Do you know any evidence about that?
I can think of two things that are relevant to this. One is that nobody has tested the adoptees in this way, to the best of my knowledge. And you know, the fact that you don't find a difference certainly doesn't mean it's not there. So there could be something the Pallier group is missing. On the other hand, given the theoretical stance of these folks, I think they were desperate to find something, and yet they didn't. And that's informative. But there is some data that's totally consistent with what you're saying. So a number of people, Worker and others, have looked at what they call heritage learners. So these are people who were exposed to a language. I think studies have been done with Korean speakers and with Spanish speakers. They were exposed to a language during early childhood. They either did or didn't begin speaking that language, and then they no longer believe that they can speak the language. And they look at their ability to relearn, essentially. If they take introductory Spanish or introductory Korean, do they do a better job in phonological perception or production than people who weren't exposed to the language? And the general finding is yes, right? A lot of the time you can find differences between those who were exposed and those who weren't. It's a little bit more difficult in that situation to be sure they really had no continued access to the language, given that they were exposed to it in the context of their families, right? So I think there's two possible reasons for this disconnect in the literature. One is that these people have continued exposure, and the other one is that we just haven't found it in the adoptees, and we're not looking at relearning there.
Right.
Yeah.
I think there's one other bit of data here, which you or Kurt, or maybe Antonio would remember, but I remember exactly. And that's that William James taught his infant son Greek verses. Does anybody remember that? Presumably nobody was there at the time. And my recollection was that there were savings until the age of 18 in relearning, but then there were none. Does this ring a bell with anyone? Well, it'd be a good project for someone to check out, see if I dreamt this or whether it's really true.
It's a gradually decaying effect, which becomes imperceptible. It's an interesting point. So what we got to do is get a big grant to go to Paris and teach all of those Korean adoptees to speak Korean again. It's a possibility. But I'm actually more interested in the in-process, right? Not what's left of that first language, but what happens when they're learning the second language. And this is a pretty unique population. You could look at issues of how cognitive development is involved in language acquisition by testing a number of L2 populations, but they all have confounds that would make it less than ideal, right? If I look at people who are learning in a classroom, I'm both looking at people who are of a different age than the infants who are typically learning their first language, and people who are learning through a totally different method, right? If I look at the children of immigrants, I'm both looking at children who are older and children who are getting a mixed set of input, who are continuing to keep their first language, right? And who are getting a lot of their input in interactions with peers and with teachers rather than with caregivers. So this is a very unique population in terms of the relationship between the first language and the second language and in terms of the input situation, right? What information is available to them about the language. And the questions that I want to get at here are, again, questions about what drives qualitative shifts in early first language acquisition, okay? So in much the same way that I was really interested in the adults because I wanted to find out about typical infants picking up a vocabulary, here I'm primarily interested in how international adoptees acquire English because I want to find out if they'll shed any light on what typically developing kids are doing when they acquire English. So are the qualitative shifts that kids go through, right, in acquiring their first language largely driven by cognitive development, or are they largely driven by the child gaining mastery over the language itself? Is it language development or cognitive development that causes shifts? And of course, they're going to be interested in the composition of the lexicon again, what words kids know and when do they know them. But we're also going to be able here to look at syntactic complexity of their early utterances, right? We know that very young children typically produce single word utterances. They begin combining words at around 18 months, and you see this syntactic explosion at 30 months. Interestingly enough, these syntactic developments are very closely linked to developments in their lexicon. Is that just chance, right? Is it driven by maturation generally? Or is there a causal link there? Looking at the adoptees is going to give us some leverage on that question. So again, we have two hypotheses on the table. One possibility is that children simply lack the capacity, right, to combine and retrieve and coordinate multiple words, and they get stuck in a one-word stage and they can't get out of it, right? Another possibility that's very popular in some parts of the language acquisition community is that syntactic abilities have to mature. So Ken Wexler, for example, over at MIT has several stories about the maturation of syntactic representations. If that's true, right, we might see a very different course of syntax acquisition in this group. The other alternative that I'm going to put forward again is that children may be gaining increasing mastery over their language, and that language acquisition by its nature, the kinds of representations that you need to build other representations, might have this stage-like characteristic, right? So, for example, maybe what you need to do is initially work with individual words so that you can have rapid retrieval of those words before you're going to be able to coordinate words. Or maybe a certain level of lexical knowledge is necessary for syntactic development. This has been a story that Liz Bates, among others, had put forward for many years, that maybe syntax, right, actually requires a sort of groundswell of lexical learning. It's only when your vocabulary gets to a certain size you begin to organize it syntactically. This is also, though, compatible with the Gleitman position that I put forward earlier. Maybe you need to know structure to learn words. That would also explain a correlation between the two. All right, so we're looking at international adoption as a natural experiment, essentially. And in order to do this, we've had to adopt two working hypotheses. They may turn out to be false, right? Part of this research project is attempting to falsify those hypotheses, but they seem like reasonable bases on which to proceed. The first hypothesis that we're adopting is that our preschool adoptees have a learning environment that roughly parallels that of a typically developing infant. So we can look at this as a change in cognitive abilities and maturation, with the environment staying relatively constant. Like young infants, they've got to acquire language from child-directed speech in the context of play and their daily routines. That's radically different, right, than our adults in the human simulation. And, critically, unlike adults or older children, there's good evidence that children under 6 have much more limited metalinguistic capabilities. They're not very good about thinking about language as an object, right? Consequently, they're unlikely to try to use more sophisticated reasoning strategies to get the language, and they may use a learning procedure more like that of the infant. These children are also unique in that they have little access to bilingual informants. Their parents sometimes pick up a little bit of their first language to travel, but they usually do not have a working knowledge of it. Our second working hypothesis is that preschool adoptees, children between ages 3 and 6, possess any putative, maturational, or cognitive prerequisites to early language acquisition. Are we claiming that because they're 3, 4, 5, and 6, if there are cognitive prerequisites to language acquisition, they have them already? Now, this is actually a hypothesis a lot of people would want to argue with, right? These kids are living in orphanages. We might expect them to have all kinds of cognitive delays. But it's critical to our argument, because we want to look at a case where the kids are more cognitively mature than typical learners, right, but are starting from scratch. So, if these two hypotheses are true, and we find that adopted preschoolers go through the same stages in language development as typically developing infants, then it would suggest that these stages themselves are not driven by cognitive development, conceptual development, or maturation. So now that we've set up the argument, I'll tell you a little bit about our participants. Our participants right now, the data I'm going to be showing you, is from 15 children adopted from China. We're continuing to collect data, and the data set is continuing to grow. The subgroup that I'll be showing you is 2.5 to 6 years of age. That's where we've been really focusing the study. And all of them have been tested between 3 and 15 months later. Now, tested here is a bit euphemistic, right? We leave most of the hard work in this study up to the parents. These children are scattered all over the United States. It would be impossible to get them to come into Boston. So we're doing the study completely through the mail. The group that we've selected are children who are primarily exposed to English after arrival. As a group, most of them are reported to have normal development in their first language. I would be incredibly skeptical of this information, though. How do the parents know? They talk to the orphanage. They talk to someone on the street, right? So this is a very coarse measure right here. And they have no other known cognitive or developmental delays, right? So we're excluding children who have Down syndrome, who seem to have other serious problems outside of language. We're not obviously measuring whether they have a language delay, because guess what? They all do, right? Because they're just learning their language. But we're looking for other signs of serious cognitive delays. Our controls are children who have been acquiring English from infancy. They're between 18 and 30 months, and they're matched for their vocabulary size on the MCDI, which is the parent report instrument, right? The same report instrument that I was showing the data from earlier. So we've taken kids who we have MCDIs from, and we found ones that have the same vocabulary size or very similar vocabulary sizes to the adoptees, and they're going to serve as our control population. We have two measures here. The parental report, the MCDI, which has a couple of different components to it. This is the MCDI-2. It's typically used with children between 16 and 30 months. That's the population it's been normed on. And it consists of a long vocabulary checklist, 677 words. Then it also has a sentence complexity measure, where the parent looks at two different sentences and tries to decide which one is most like their child's speech. So they might hear something like, mommy go versus mommy went, right? Or mommy shoe versus mommy shoe. And what we're measuring is the proportion of times, the number of times, the parent checked off the more complicated form, the more syntactically complex form. While this instrument is intended for typically developing children between 16 and 30 months, it's also been used to study a wide variety of children who are developing language more slowly. So it's been used with children with Williams syndrome, Down syndrome, language delayed children. Now, of course, we're always a little bit suspicious when we're getting most of our data from the parents themselves, right? Parents are awfully enthusiastic about their own child's development. So we get another measure as well. And what we've chosen to do here is collect a language sample from the children. We send them a box of toys, and their job is to open up the box of toys, put a videotape into the camera, and then sit and play with their child for an hour. Then they send this videotape back, and we transcribe it. Well, we try to keep up with the transcription. That's one of the big problems for us. And we look at whether there's a relationship between the videotape that we got, right, and what the parents checked off. And I'll show you a little bit of preliminary data on that. That's a lot of what we're still doing now. Each child in this study participated in between 1 and 4 sessions, right? So the children came in. Some of them had been here for 3 months. Some of them had been here for 15. If they hadn't already been here for 15 months, we invited them to participate again every 3 months in an attempt to maximize the amount of data that we could collect. Some parents did, some parents didn't, and we ended up with an average of 1.8 observations per child. All right. I was hoping to show you a little video clip of the kids themselves. We weren't able to get the VCR running. One interest in watching them is that their speech in many ways really does look like the kind of speech you see toddlers producing, right? But that's that's a very qualitative judgment here. What really stands out from this videotape, though, is that in many ways these children are cognitively well beyond, right, the two-year-olds who are usually speaking like this. So in the videotape that we have a boy going helicopter, helicopter, mommy, helicopter, mommy, helicopter, right, trying to find a way to express he wants mommy to look at his helicopter and, you know, that he's going to make a helicopter without any verbs. But at the same time, he's producing out of Play-Doh this fabulous helicopter, right? He's stacking up blocks 20 high and talking to us like an 18-month-old, essentially. We got to get something a little bit more concrete on the table, right? So what we're going to start is by looking at some of the data from that parent report instrument. And we're going to look at children's vocabulary composition. What words do they know? Now, what I'm graphing here is the children's vocabulary size. So you'll notice that the issue of time, how long did it take them to get there, has completely disappeared from this graph, and we'll get back to that. What I'm graphing along the y-axis is the proportion of the words that they know that are nouns. Right? Obviously, these kids' vocabulary is growing larger. The question is it staying mostly made up of nouns, or do they know fewer nouns over time? And there's two lines on this graph. The green line is the average for the Chinese adoptees, and what you'll see is that they know more nouns early on. Nouns make up a higher proportion of their vocabularies, and that proportion decreases as the vocabularies grow larger. So starting out with this noun bias, which is diminishing over time. This is exactly the same as the infant learners, and there's no reliable difference between the two. Both show a highly reliable effect of vocabulary size on noun composition. Okay? This is a very similar graph for the verbs, a lot noisier actually. Here what we see is that verb proportions start out relatively low, both for the adoptees and for the infant learners, and they increase over time. They learn more verbs over time. The other thing we want to look at is their use of function words. We haven't really talked much about this, but you remember when I put the Jabberwocky slides up on the board, and they had words like can and the and are and is, right? They had the grammatical words left in. Well, one way of describing those grammatical words is as function words or closed class items. These are words that have relatively little semantic content, relatively little meaning, but serve a lot of the grammatical functions in an utterance. What we see here is that both groups have a very low proportion of closed class items in their early vocabularies, right? But that really starts to pick up as their vocabulary size increases. So the take-home message here is that vocabulary composition looks identical in the two groups. We really see no differences between the preschoolers at 4, 3, 4, and 5, right, and the toddlers who are typically developing. The next thing we want to look at is whether we see the same relationship between word learning and syntax in our international adoptees that we see in typically developing kids. So here again, I'm graphing vocabulary size, but this time on the y-axis, we have the sentence complexity score. How many times did the parent check off the more complex sentence? And the results for the infant learners here nicely match what's been reported in the literature. Very early on, when vocabularies are under about 300 words, children show very little evidence of syntactic complexity, right? They're producing simple two-word utterances at that point. However, when vocabulary hits between about 300 and 500 words, you see this sudden jump in complexity. They begin producing tense markers, right? Saying, mommy walked rather than mommy walk. They begin producing the auxiliary verbs. They begin producing sentences that have question words in them, like when and why and where. And that's also true of our Chinese adoptees. Now, to make this a little bit more concrete, right, another way to learn a language, other than the way that these infants seem to be doing it, or our preschoolers seem to be doing it, is by starting out with memorized phrases, right? This is a lot of how many of us get around when we barely know a second language. We memorize a phrase, we know a couple of set phrases, and we produce them. If our children were doing that, we would see high sentence complexity from very early on. We see a large number of function words and verbs from very early on. They seem to be taking the same approach as infants, which is synthesizing it, right? Starting with small units and building up to big, rather than starting with big units and analyzing it down. And several reports of language acquisition in school-age populations, children who are learning language from their peers, has suggested that starting big and breaking it down is much more common in those groups, right? And this may have to do with the situations these children are in. They're not forced to, the preschool children aren't forced to engage their interlocutors in the same way. Their parents are going to be there, and they're going to meet their needs. Many have argued that children who learn a second language in school have to take shortcuts because they have to keep the other children engaged. They have to appear to be understanding and appear to be communicating while they're still grasping onto the language. All right, Now we get to the question of rate, though, right? I've been telling you these preschoolers are exactly like infants, but there's one big caveat here. The rate at which they're picking up the vocabulary is radically different. Here what I've done is I've graphed the norm for the MacArthur Communicative Development Inventory, right? And this is from the National Norming Sample. And what you can see is that for typically developing kids, when they start learning words, they go very slow and it accelerates. We've seen that function before. And here I'm assuming that children begin learning words right around 12 months. There's a simplifying assumption here. So if we say that here's 12 months, right, it takes them about a year to get to a vocabulary of 300 words. But look what's happening with our adoptees. There we're seeing a very different function. They are shooting up from nowhere, right, and then they appear to be leveling off. And again, that's an illusion, right? That leveling off may very well be because they're hitting the top of the MCDI. So we don't see continued growth. And they're actually hitting that top by around 10 months. If you look at the 300 word mark here, right, what we see is by around 4 months, many of our children have achieved what takes a typically developing infant a year to achieve. So there is a really big difference, and that is in the rate of acquisition. If we look at how lexical development relates to grammatical development, if we look at vocabulary composition, the two groups are identical. But the speed here seems to be very different. And one of the things that we want to do now is to try to follow this up by doing a longitudinal sample. We can actually carefully follow some kids and look at how their speed of word learning changes over time. All right, so we have some preliminary conclusions, and I've probably given most of them away along the way, right? We see the same shifts in vocabulary composition in both groups. What does that lead us to conclude? Well, it strongly suggests that vocabulary composition is shaped by your linguistic knowledge, right, and your input, rather than being primarily shaped by the conceptual limitations of the learner. So we've come full circle here, back to where we were with the human simulation paradigms. We also found that preschoolers had accelerated early vocabulary growth. That really suggests a place where cognitive maturity matters, right? Cognitive immaturity may be hampering infant word learning. Or there's an alternative here. Learning a first language may make it easier to learn a second language, right? And we can't really disentangle that in our data. These kids have all learned a second language as well, or learned a first language as well. Found is that this correlation between grammar and the lexicon, right, between syntax and word meanings, it holds up even when we look at a population where many of the likely confounds are removed, right, maturational confounds and confounds related to cognitive development. This is strongly consistent with any theory that posits a causal relationship between word knowledge and syntax knowledge. And that includes stories where syntax comes out of the lexicon essentially by learning more words, and stories where you need syntax in order to learn more words. Right? This is a bi-directional relationship here. One of the questions that always comes up is whether the measure we're using is actually valid for our population. There's really two explanations for the results that we get. One possibility is that our adopted preschoolers really do show the same vocabulary development pattern as typically developing kids, right? That they really do show the same kinds of syntactic knowledge as typically developing kids. The alternative is that our adults in these studies know what to expect, and they impose their vision of what language acquisition should look like onto their children when they fill out these reports. So one of the things that we're doing with the speech samples we've collected from the kids is attempting to validate the parental report. And this is a first baby step towards doing that. What I've graphed here is the child's mean length of utterance from their spontaneous speech sample. So these are children who are just combining two words most of the time. These are children who have utterances with four different words or four different morphemes, meaning-bearing units, right? And what we can see is that there's a relationship between their MLU and their parents' reported complexity score, suggesting the parents are picking up on something when they attempt to decide whether their child produces the simpler or the more complex utterance. We also get that correlation when we look at vocabulary size with MLU. Okay. The next question that's come up for me is attempting to understand what the role is of the child's first language in developing the second language. I told you that these adoptees look a lot like typically developing English speakers. They begin with short 2-3 word utterances that don't have a lot of the functional content. They say mommy throw rather than mommy is throwing, right? They say ball rather than the ball. They're leaving off a lot of function words. One explanation for this is that, like typically developing kids, they learn the content words first and they fill in the function morphemes later. But there's a second possibility. All of the data that I've shown you is from children who had as their first language a Chinese language, right? Chinese, like English, has a very fixed word order. Like English, it is morphologically impoverished. That means it has relatively few morphological endings, right? Not complex conjugations of verbs, but even more so, right? Even more so than English, there are very few function words, really essentially no inflectional morphology. Chinese also has a very interesting property, all Chinese languages, that you can drop the subject of the sentence and the object of the sentence if the situation will allow the listener to construe what the subject and object should be, right? So those of you who have taken Spanish are also familiar with it, so you can drop the subject. In Chinese, you can also drop the object. So in essence, mommy kissed me can become kiss if it's clear who the kisser is and who the kissy is. Now, these properties might lead these native Chinese speakers to sound a lot more like infants, right? If they're dropping arguments, they're leaving off inflectional morphemes. So to get at that question, we've begun to collect data from Eastern European adoptees, specifically children who are learning a Slavic language before being adopted. Slavic languages make a really nice contrast with Chinese languages. They have a very free word order. Words and phrases can move around quite easily, and the reason why they can do that is that they have lots of little morphemes on them that tell you what their role is. Right? So a noun will have a little ending that says, I'm an object, right? Or a verb will agree with the noun quite explicitly. So there's a lot of inflectional morphology, free word order, and critically, no argument dropping, right? So if it's a property of the languages that are imposing this look on the children's production, then we should see radically different patterns across these two groups of kids. And it's very early days on this data, but so far there's really no sign of that. The Eastern European adoptees are the red squares here. And I'm going to show you a couple of graphs. Here for the nouns, we see that they also are showing a declining proportion of nouns in their vocabulary, starting out noun dominant, and then learning more words of different kinds as time goes on. And they're showing an increasing proportion of verbs in their early production. Critically, where we might expect to see the biggest differences would be in the relationship between syntax and the lexicon. Right? These kids come from a language where overt argument marking, right, where inflectional morphology is critical. So if they're going to import that expectation into English, we might expect they would be able to pick up those morphemes quite quickly and produce much more complex utterances when their vocabularies are still quite small. But we're not seeing that at all. Again, what we're seeing, right, is an acceleration with syntactic complexity really taking off between about 300 and 500 words. Now, the final question that we've begun to address goes back to our working hypotheses, right? I told you that two things really had to be true for this data to get at the issues that I want to get at. One is that these kids have to be more maturationally advanced, and the other is that they actually have to be getting input that's roughly similar to what infants get. We've begun looking at the first of those two questions. Are our adopted preschoolers really more maturationally advanced than typically developing toddlers? And there's a really big reason why you might be skeptical about this data. These kids grew up in orphanages, right? We know that orphanage children raised in orphanages show delays in their physical growth, quite considerable delays in their physical growth. They show delays in their motor development. We know that they also show cognitive delays. These delays seem to be very variable across populations, and they also are very difficult to test, especially in children who are not speaking English. So the typical way in which delays are assessed in these children when they come to the United States is they're given a Denver developmental screening exam, right, or some other exam by a pediatrician in English, and then the pediatrician makes some assumptions about their level of development. At this point in time, just 2 or 3 months into their time in the United States, their English is minimal. And so there's a number of studies that document extensive language delays in these populations. Of course, it's kind of uninteresting, right? They haven't had much time to learn the language. All right, so what we want to do is actually go in and try to get some measurement of these children's development that was not linked to their language abilities, right? Now, we don't need to find out that they're developmentally equivalent to their age mates. Right? They don't have to be as developmentally mature as a typical 4 or 5-year-old. We only need to know that they're as mature as toddlers who have completed these shifts in language development. So we want to know that at the beginning of language acquisition, right, beginning of acquiring the second language, these children are as cognitively mature as 30-month-old infants who have already gone through these syntactic changes and these changes in vocabulary composition. If that's true, and we see our adoptees go through these changes, we can't invoke that same kind of conceptual maturation to account for it, okay? So our solution has been to develop yet another parental report instrument based on the ages and stages questionnaire, tonight because we somehow have to assess the developmental level of these children who really can't come into our office. The Ages and Stages questionnaire is used to screen for developmental delays. There's forms of it that run from 15 months all the way up to 6 years. We're interested in looking at developments that happen during infancy, some that happen during the toddler years when these shifts in vocabulary are going on, and some that happen during preschool. So we have taken all of the questionnaires from about 15 months to about 48 months, and we've taken out all of the items that refer to language in any way, that either test the child's language, right, or that rely on giving a linguistic prompt or linguistic response. And then we've created this enormous Ages and Stages questionnaire, which we send off to the parents and have them complete now, hopefully, the beginning and end of the study. And we only have this information for a small number of our participants at this point. So let me just give you a sense of the three types of milestones we're looking at. First, we want to make sure that our parents are actually willing to say that their children have passed some milestones, milestones that we're quite sure that they've passed, both for our control kids and for our adoptees. So we have one set of milestones that typically come in between 12 and 21 months. We expect ceiling performance from both groups here. The critical group of milestones is the toddler group. These are ones that usually come in roughly around the time that these changes in syntactic development are going on, right, and changes in vocabulary composition. Here, what we should expect is that our typically developing kids, our control kids, right, are going to be right in the middle of these milestones. They're going to achieve some and not others, but we expect that our adoptees should have passed these. And finally, to make sure that the parents of the adoptees aren't just checking everything, right, or to make sure that the parents of the toddlers aren't just checking everything, we also include some milestones that come in between about 36 and 60 months. These are the actual age that our preschoolers are, right? So here we should see they haven't passed all of them. And here's just some examples of the kind of thing we're asking, right? There's some gross motor questions. So for infants, does your child walk and seldom fall? For toddlers, does your child jump with both feet leaving the floor at the same time? And for preschoolers, right, can they hop up and down on either their right foot or their left foot for a certain amount of time? There's actually a 5-second one, too. Then we have some on problem solving. We only could pull out the problem solving questions that didn't require language specifically. So with infants, it's about putting two objects into a box. With toddlers, it's about solving the problem of getting something you want by moving a chair. Right? With preschoolers, it's asking about pretend play and play acting. And here are the preliminary data from our preliminary ASQs. I divided up both groups into ones who were low in syntax and high in syntax. Right? So children who have, I think, 10 or fewer check marks on their syntax inventory, and children with more than 10. And here we have our control toddlers. What you see here is that our control toddlers have not passed practically any of the preschool milestones in blue. Not surprising, right? They shouldn't be getting to these things for another couple of years yet. They're right in the middle of passing their toddler milestones. Again, that's to be expected, right? They're doing the things that toddlers are supposed to do. And they're pretty much at ceiling for the infant measures. Here we have our adopted preschoolers, both our low syntax and high syntax. And we're particularly interested in our low syntax guys, right? Because they're the ones, if their low syntax is caused in some way by cognitive immaturity, we should see them being less mature on this measure than our high syntax control toddlers. Right? Okay. And instead, what we see is they're pretty close to ceiling on the toddler milestones. They seem to have passed through most of these, right, up at 89% there. And they're working their way through the preschool milestones. So I think we've come a long ways towards demonstrating that these kids are definitely more mature than their language would suggest. I'll tell you a little bit about some of the directions we're heading in right now. Our data collection still continues. We really want to know what happens in the first few months, right? I showed you on that graph, by the time we're catching them at 3 to 4 months, we have kids who have vocabularies of 300 words. There's a lot of interesting things that happen in typically developing kids in that first 300 words, and we're not capturing any of that yet. So we've recently started a longitudinal study where we actually attempt to recruit the parents before they go to adopt their children, and then have them keep records that begin in the first month and continue throughout the first 6 months, and regular samples of their interactions with them as well. We also continue to attempt to test our working hypotheses. One thing we'll be looking at with the transcript soon, is the parental speech to adoptees really like infant-directed speech, right? And we're going to want to compare it to the kind of speech that parents of preschoolers give to their typically developing preschoolers. So is it more like infant-directed speech or more like the speech that preschoolers hear? And, of course, we're continuing to find out about the cognitive maturity of this group. We also have a goal here, right? I've been tell you about some very general questions about how complex your utterances are, what words you know. But I think there's a lot of very focused questions that are of interest to syntacticians and linguists who are interested in language acquisition that could be addressed with the kind of data we're collecting. One of our goals here is to create a database of transcripts of these children's spontaneous speech so that people who have theories about when particular constructions might develop and whether those constructions are largely maturationally driven can go to this database and actually look at whether they appear at the predicted time in our toddler, in our preschool sample. And finally, here are all of the people who worked on this. In the human simulations, this was an ongoing collaboration with Lila Gleitman. The Mandarin studies were with Peggy Lee and Sylvia Wan. There's been some modeling based on this with Michael Brent. And there were some absolutely fabulous research assistants that helped actually years ago on some of that. In the international adoption, my collaborators have been Joy Guerin, who is in the psychology department, and then Isabel Martin, who is an undergraduate who graduated here from a couple years ago, really got this started with me. And again, we've had some fantastic assistance from Sylvia Yuan, Mavish Malik, our lab coordinators, Laura Axe, Carolyn Whiting. And finally, we've gotten so much help in this work from the parents. They're doing all the data collection here. So I'd like to thank them and all of the organizations who agreed to distribute our information and help us contact them.